buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What should you want to know?
Hi, Bill Radke here. Welcome to Friday. And welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. We're going to discuss the big events of the week with my guests, the Mossback from Crosscut, Knut Berger, Seattle Channel's Joni Balter, and from the environmental site Grist, Katie Herzog. Welcome, team.
Good morning.
Thank you.
We have all been watching these Washington wildfires, 1,100 square miles of fire, size of Rhode Island, biggest fire complex in recorded state history. And Governor Inslee said yesterday that this represents a new normal, a new normal. How does life in Washington state change if fires like these are the new normal? Here is one answer from Meg Donahue. She owns Blue Star Coffee Roasters in Twisp in the Meadow Valley. Last year, her property burned in the Carlton Complex fire. Only a small cabin was left standing on her land. This year's fire forced her to leave her new home and go back to that little cabin. And Marcy Silman asked her what that was like.
Well, it was bittersweet. Gosh, it's kind of hard to describe, Marcy. It's a place that it's definitely our heart's home. And so losing it last year was really difficult. So...
Are you okay?
Yeah. Having it be a haven was really awesome. They're just, the impacts here on everybody are really deep, you know. And I would say the majority of people in the valley have some version of that story, you know, and are kind of grappling with our relationship to our home. The impacts of last year were really just kind of starting to sink in this year, right before these fires hit. They're so long term.
Meg, what's the atmosphere like these days in your coffee shop in this small town?
You know, we are lucky in that we have become sort of a hub in our town, and people come in, and a lot of them are exhausted. Most of them are exhausted. And so there's just nothing better than to be able to make somebody a cup of coffee when they're in that state. People are also really glad to see each other and connect. You know, there are lots of those moments. I'm concerned about the impacts of having this happen 2 years in a row. It's one thing to think about it in terms of it being an anomaly and something we recover from, even though it takes a long time to recover. We're going to recover. And then it's another thing to think about it as being the new normal.
And when she said that, it really hit me how it is one thing to survive a disaster and rally around one disaster. I'm thinking of the Oso landslide, which is hard and awful enough. But I could imagine the burden feeling even heavier if you think that, as the governor said this week, this is the new normal. So as I asked, Joni Balter, how does life in Washington change if fires like these are the new normal?
Well, you have to think about sort of what goes on in central Washington. Tourism, apple growing, wine growing. The folks there are, as she's saying, changing their expectations about how things are going to be in the future and what, you know, how they're going to relate to their land. You know, I'm a 25-year visitor to Lake Chelan. I was hiking just 3 weeks ago exactly where that Twisp fire was. And so I really feel how these folks, what they're going through. And if you think about it, let's say that you live in an area next to a river, and it's a 100-year flood place.
Mm-hmm.
So you think, okay, it's going to flood every 100 years. But then all of a sudden, out of 5 years, it floods three times. You begin to relate to that much differently than you have in the past. And similarly, here in fire country, where the temperatures are, 105 degrees, very little rain, and you have two back-to-back years with really, really unbelievably big fires, you are going to sort of have to change how you relate to that and what you expect. You have to change what you think is going to happen next. And that's why this woman sounds so emotional, and our hearts go out to her.
Right. Katie Herzog, how does life change if this is the new normal?
Well, it's a good question. And I think the problem is that if we talk about this as a new normal, then it's sort of this acceptance that this is happening. So people can do things on their own. Individual homeowners can do things to prepare their homes for the worst. But we also have to, we need governments to help us out to make, land management and forest management, make policies so that these things aren't going to happen as much, deal with, instead of, attacking the fires after they happen, try to have plans in place so this doesn't happen in the future. But really the big issue here is that these things are happening because of the carbon in the atmosphere. And if we're ignoring that, then this is going to be the new normal. And I feel like that's a problem. We need to get to the root of this.
Yeah, so maybe the climate change part is going to be hard to control anytime soon. But maybe we shouldn't admit that this is the new normal if there actually is fire prevention. We've talked about thinning forests and, controlled burns and not living in fire-prone areas and all these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Knut Berger, how does life change if this is the new normal?
Well, sort of look at it from some of the policy areas. I think it's absolutely right that even though you can't say that what's happening now is the result of global warming, what we do know for sure is that the kind of year we've had matches the models that were of that say what global warming is going to produce for us. So that's why we're worried about it being the new normal. And I had a look at this earlier this year when I went up in the Cedar River watershed, and there was virtually no snowpack up there. And they were telling me about, it's not the water supply that's the issue. The issue is the whole ecosystem, which is, fish and rivers and everything. That when you don't have snowpack in the summer, these high old growth forests that are part of our water system dry out. And so one of the interesting things is that, we think of fires as an Eastern Washington thing, but we're finding out, no, that this is a Western Washington thing. We've had the Olympic rainforest. We've had problems in the North Cascades. We could see how it's disrupting power supply. We can see how it is affecting fish habitat. So we have to, we have to address those things in terms of infrastructure planning, working on the carbon issue, taking that much more seriously. And the legislature has to do practical things. I mean, they did not give the firefighting money to the Department of Natural Resources that was requested precisely because they were expecting a difficult fire season. And we have to, we have to put resources to this. You can't pretend it's just not going to happen.
We've been asking, what if 1,100 square miles of fire is the new normal? So we've talked about the effects on industry, the effects on our own expectations. And then there's the idea that maybe you thought the new normal was about Eastern Washington. What if the new normal starts to involve, as Knut says, Western Washington as well? Are the fires the new normal because of climate change, we asked? Well, KUOW's EarthFix reporter Jess Burns told us this week that it's not that simple.
There's no easy answer to this question. We know that temperatures are getting hotter. We know that parts of the Northwest are in drought. But weather is not the only factor in how widespread and how intensely wildfires are burning. There's geography, there's vegetation type, and we're coming off a century of wildfire suppression in the West, and consequently there's been a buildup of fuels in the forest. And there's also the effects that humans have in how we choose and when we choose to fight those fires.
You can hear our whole conversation with Jess Burns and our other fire coverage at KUOW.org. Search the word wildfire. People are talking about this right now, in fact, on our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio, and we're live tweeting the show at KUOW. State officials say they will investigate one of Washington's premier high school football programs. This week, Seattle Times reported that some Bellevue High football players actually attend a small private school in the city, a school that critics call a diploma mill, a place that helps kids play football without doing so much learning. Two Bellevue High coaches have been suspended for providing money to a player's family. So, since competitive sports can come at the expense of academics, our question is, what role should sports play in our public schools, if any? Journalist Buzz Bissinger has reported on this issue, and he wrote the book, Friday Night Lights. He joins us. He lives on the Washington coast now in Long Beach. And Buzz Bissinger, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, before we talk school sports in general, what about Bellevue High School? How serious are these accusations?
Well, this makes anything in Friday Night Lights, honestly, look incidental. I've been racking
my
brain. I think this is the worst sports scandal that I've ever heard of involving high school. This is a high school that should be ashamed of itself, that should get the death penalty, that is basically parking players, hired guns at a private school that may simply be a diploma mill. I assume because they can't make it at Bellevue or because they don't live in the district. So there's six or seven players over the years who have done this. It's pathetic. It's child abuse. And I see the head of the Boosters is a former Microsoft executive. Is this the way you win? Is this the way you teach your kids? I think his name is Coach Goncharov. He should be gone. He should be ashamed of himself and more than ashamed of himself, because I see this a matter of child abuse. Because what you're also saying to these kids are, you know what? We don't care about your education. Academics are an obstacle to be overcome. And, hey, we have a great idea. Go to this private school. We'll pay the tuition. We have no idea what education you're getting. You're basically not being monitored. According to the Seattle Times, parents were able to change the grade. So we don't really care about academics. We just want you to play football. And you know what? The odds of making it in college are infinitesimal. The odds of making it in the pros are more infinitesimal. So you know what? If you're not good enough, if you fall by the wayside, so what? And I also think Bellevue should be stripped of all its state championships where these players involved. And this isn't said for hyperbole. And what's shocking to me, this is Washington State. I would never, ever have expected Texas, yes, Washington State, and it shows me that the core of too many football programs and basketball programs and other programs are rotten to the core.
Now, our listeners may not have known, I didn't know, that students are allowed to play for a public high school as long as they keep their grades up at a private school like the one located in this Bellevue shopping center. This school, the Academic Institute, denies that it gives students special privileges, and the state hasn't even started the investigation. So we'll learn more. But as I asked a moment ago, Buzz, what role should sports play?
Reputation, and it was filled with holes.
Say that one more time.
I read the reputation by the private school. I'm not sure what it's called, and it was filled with holes. It was very, very general, and as trying to refute what the Seattle Times wrote, I find it totally unconvincing.
So the bigger picture, what role do you think? You've covered this. You've written for Sports Illustrated. You wrote Friday Night Lights. You just said this is worse than anything you wrote. What role should sports, competitive inter-school sports, have in our public schools at this point, if any at all?
Well, you know, I think at this point in time, you could argue they have no role, but they're there. They're going to have a role. And sports, under the right conditions, can be great. It can be used as a tool of intervention to keep kids in school. It can be a tool of academic motivation. It can be a tool to encourage teamwork, camaraderie, having dreams, working hard. But it has to be ancillary to the academic environment. You know, it's a big, fat, global world out there. We are losing ground. We're losing ground to other nations. And part of the reason we're losing ground to other nations is because so much of high school, and college for that matter, is dithering around and extracurricular activities. And, oh, yeah, by the way, you're going to do some studying and some academics. Study after study has shown that the amount of time the kids spend studying has gone down. And part of it is because the sports becomes the mainstay. As I say, academics are not embraced. It's an obstacle. It's an obstacle to be overcome. And this, you know, that's not unique to Bellevue. All these superpower schools who want to be in some mythical, ridiculous USA Today Top 25 poll that is based on no science whatsoever, all those schools, you know, let's just push them through academically. We don't really care if they learn anything, and we don't really care if down the road they're successful or not.
So and clearly so, you're disgusted with the situation, and yet you're saying that, well, it's there, you know, we're going to have it,
but
we could
I could suggest The only thing you could suggest, you know, suggestions are fine, but suggestions are hollow. And I'm not going to suggest something for the sake of suggesting something. The only, you know, it's there. It's not going away. You could suggest get rid of it entirely, but it's not going
to
happen.
Well, we could. So parents, do you think it ought to happen? I mean, this movements start and things change. Maybe a long time down the road. But I just want to know where you stand. If you're the king of the world, do we have these sports programs?
I get rid of it in the high school level, and if kids want to play on club teams. I moved to the European model. The European model is an honest model. Now, obviously, they don't play American football. But European schools, where kids are much better educated, they don't have sports in their schools. They have club teams. And if you're a really, really good soccer player, you go to an academy at the age of 7 or 8, i.e., you are there to learn soccer and get some academics. And that's what should happen with sports in America. But to say it's going to happen, it's not. To say that Bellevue is going to get rid of football, it isn't. But that would be the alternative, and it's up to parents. I mean, parents, you're right. Parents can move things, and let's see how much they really care. Let's see how much this story sticks.
Okay.
And I'll tell you the other thing. If the, you know, state officials dither around, they don't really do much, they really didn't investigate allegations that were there, if they actually investigate this and if they actually come down really hard on Bellevue, as they should, not to single them out, as they should, other schools would take notice. So I think Bellevue should be suspended from playing this season. I think their state titles should be stripped for any game involving these 7 players. And I think the coach should be fired. End of story.
Friday Night Lights author Buzz Bischinger, stay on the line. Joni Balter, you have a kid playing sports. You've said that sports do have an important role in public schools.
Absolutely. But let me start by agreeing with Buzz on one thing, and that is that Bellevue should be heavily sanctioned. Basically, they were teaching the kids how to cheat. They were saying, you're not good enough, so you guys, if we do a little jiggering here, that we'll fix everything for you. So that absolutely sanctions all of that. But I also think that just a few bad actors, or maybe there's even more bad actors, should not change sort of how we view the role of sports in public high schools. And I'll give you an example. If you think about Garfield High School had a problem with a choir teacher and a trip. And so they didn't end up saying, let's get rid of all the music programs. They did something different. They got rid of that teacher. And so you really have to be honest about how important sports are. And I'll take that from a public health angle. We need more opportunities for kids to be athletic and to be fit, not fewer. I would argue that the obesity epidemic is way worse than the public high school sports epidemic, for example.
Buzz?
Look, I think the caller, you know, makes some excellent points. And by the way, where sports really do work in high school and college are women's sports. And that's been proven by studies. They do better academically. They use it to get ahead in life. There's certain sports like track where the kids do better. But when you have these football programs who eat up a lot of money and a lot of time, I'm sure there's some schools that do it right. But I think there are a lot of schools, their obsession is with winning. And coaches' obsession is with winning. And I think Goncharov got paid $55,000 extra by the Booster Club. And by the way, in Texas, the highest paid coach makes $137,000 a year and teaches no classes.
Buzz, on our Facebook page, Debbie makes the point. She says, yes to sports for fun, fitness, discipline, pride, spirit. No kid should have to miss out on sports because his or her parents are poor. You suggested we go to a private club sports model. If that happened, what would happen to the poorest kids who love to play, want to play sports now?
Well, you know, you could give out scholarships. What you're suggesting is exactly what Bellevue did. These are poor kids, so you know what? We'll have a booster pay the tuition. Now, if you want to do it, that's fine. Or we'll have the coach pay the tuition. And he's not paying the tuition because he's altruistic. He's paying the tuition so these kids can play. It can be fashioned so kids get scholarships. I know a program.
Scholarships to who gives scholarships? Scholarships to what?
A program in Harlem that teaches lacrosse where they do exactly that. And when kids go to camps that cost money, these kids who obviously can't afford it get scholarships. And they get money to go to these camps, and you could do the same thing.
From foundations?
You're not going to get rid of high school sports, and in a time of dwindling resources for many schools, you're not going to have phys ed programs.
Well, that's the point. So once you get rid of the phys ed and gym, it's better to at least have a public high school sanctioned activity after school. You already missed gym. Now what are you going to do physically?
Well, I mean, I think high schools have, and I agree, but I think high schools have decided that, you know, because of dwindling resources, we're only really going to fund, you know, major teams in a sense, or teams that, you know, compete with other high schools. You know, I don't know any school in the country that has reintroduced phys ed, and phys ed should be part of, you know, at a much younger age, but they've all gotten rid of it, and I think it does add to the obesity crisis. But I don't think schools are you know, it costs a lot of money, and, you know, they don't want to spend it.
Also on our Facebook page, Sean says, I don't think sports should play any role in schools. A classical education is what we need. I don't remember the name of the last jock that solved a major world problem. What do you say to that Lakeside graduate, Knut Berger?
Well, I'm not anti-jock, although, yeah, I have to confess I was a gym flake in high school.
You played for the croquet team. Come on.
And, he's not kidding.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think the big problem here is, obviously, it's not the kids. It's the adults, I mean, who take things too far, who begin and the whole idea of public education in the beginning was to create a populace that was able to operate in a functional democracy. In other words, people needed to learn to read and write. And, you know, part of that, I think, is to create or cultivate good citizens. And I think our schools have gotten away from that. When you look at all the kind of reform effort, I mean, you have teachers that are and administrators who are cheating on test scores. You've got boosters who are cheating on football. You have corporate guys who think schools should do nothing but turn out scientists or software writers. You know, I just think the adults are the problem here. And if you initiated a program where even the parents of students had to go to some kind of mandatory ethics training or something, we'd probably all be better off. I don't have a problem with high school sports. Just like I don't have a problem with a chess team or the debate club or student government or anything like that. I think that's all great. But no, it's just you get these people who become obsessed with winning at all costs. And that's not something that is going to help America be a better country. It doesn't help our, kids become better people.
Okay, and you and Buzz seem to agree. This is human nature. Adults are who they are. So you're king of the world. Do you agree that sports gone from public schools?
No, I don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is what adults, coaches, boosters do with it.
Yeah, but we're not going to change adult human nature, right?
Well, we're not going to change. No, but as Buzz says, we can penalize them. We can raise them as an example, but we can also recommit the schools to creating more ethical environments.
Okay, we've been talking with Buzz Bissinger, who wrote the book Friday Night Lights, and says this is beyond anything I've written, and Bellevue High ought to be stripped of all its championships, etc. He used the term child abuse. Buzz Bissinger, thanks for commiserating with us about sports in schools. We appreciate it.
All right, no problem. Thank you.
Buzz Bissinger will be in Seattle. He lives in Long Beach now. He'll be in Seattle September 22nd, by the way, at University Bookstore, talking about his book, Friday Night Lights, so you can talk him up yourself. Any final word, Katie Herzog, on what role sports ought to play in public schools?
Get rid of them. If I were dictator of the world, no more sports.
This is KUOW's Week in Review. Coming up, what rights does a Seattle gun buyer have? Who should pay the cost of gun violence? Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review with Katie Herzog, Knut Berger, Joni Balter. I'm Bill Radke. We're learning from, debating the news of the week. Pioneer Square is Seattle's birthplace, with century-old brick buildings that link us to the days of Yesler's Sawmill and the Klondike Gold Rush. One of those buildings is slated for demolition, and that might alarm you. But we're not talking about a historic hotel or a Pioneer Saloon. So the question is, which parts of our history are worth preserving? Let's ask a couple of neighbors.
I'm sure we've met at some point.
Me too.
But I don't think we've had.
Since we're neighbors,
are you in
the big, funny-looking white dog that has the sad face.
I've got the little black dog with the white face.
I'm sure we've seen each other.
Because they're neighbors. Pioneer Square residents Greg Aiden and Ann Fennessy. Now, Greg does not like that the city wants to build a solid, modern-looking, 11-story apartment building on Alaskan Way. He doesn't want that building to replace what's there now, the two-story building, even though what it is a parking garage. So I asked him, what's so important about a parking garage?
It is true that we question the status of this building. It has been deemed historical but non-contributing. But my group, Save Our Square, came to this issue a little bit late, and we were unable to contest that designation. We believe in responsible growth, and this building is modern and out of scale and just doesn't really fit the character of the neighborhood. That's our issue.
Well, let's talk about what's modern, what's out of scale, and what is non-contributing. Also with us is Ann Fennessy. She's a resident of Pioneer Square, one of the founders of the Pioneer Square Residents Council. Ann, I'll ask you the same question. Which parts of our history are worth preserving, and what does that have to do with the parking garage?
I think Pioneer Square is an incredibly precious and important neighborhood for the city. I live directly across the street on Jackson Street, and I don't think there's anything important about that building. And I think there are many buildings that are of higher architectural and historical importance that are being neglected. The issue in Pioneer Square is, how do we make sure that we don't deteriorate with 1,000 cuts? How do we make sure that the landscape, the sidewalks, the streets, the buildings that are historically significant are taken care of?
Anne, I like so much of what you've said. What you have to understand is it's not just about this building. This building will create precedence. You're going to have very tall buildings, modern buildings, shooting up within this beautiful piece of history. And I think that's really very sad, very sad.
Anne, it sounds like Greg is describing a domino effect. And what are we doing to our most historic neighborhood in Seattle?
I think we need to remember that the biggest threat to Pioneer Square is no economic and human core here. We have very large buildings, which I do not believe had destroyed the historic nature of this neighborhood, and we don't have the kind of density for people to feel like this is a real neighborhood. Most people come through the neighborhood, but don't stay in the neighborhood, and that's what we need to create here.
So, Greg, you just heard Ann Fennessy say, to answer my question, which parts of our history are worth preserving, she finds that you preserve that historic neighborhood, and we already have preservation in place for those most of those buildings. You preserve it with vitality, with density. How do you answer the question, which parts of our history are worth preserving and why?
Well, first of all, you have to look at Pioneer Square as a canvas. Okay, this is a single work of art, and it's beautiful. So you don't take a Picasso and splatter paint on it because you want it to be a Jackson Pollock. Let's keep these buildings to scale.
But it's not the building. It's the land use zone that you're unhappy with. The building is not attractive. I get that. But we have different histories and different times that buildings have been built in Pioneer Square. I keep trying to figure out, why are we going through lawsuits instead of sitting down and negotiating to see between the city and the developer what can be resolved? And instead, I feel like we are going through lawsuits instead of trying to fix the problem.
With all due respect,
I love this neighborhood. I have been here for almost 20 years.
But with all due respect, we went through that process.
Now we're getting a little specific to the process of this one case, and I'd like to just get Ann's answer to. Ann, what do you say to your neighbor's concern about the splattering of a Picasso?
I don't believe that we're splattering a Picasso, because I would never, ever say that that garage is a Picasso. And I feel like this building is taking away from the real question is, how do we keep the neighborhood and the buildings and the economics of this neighborhood viable?
That was Pioneer Square residents Ann Fennessy and Greg Aiden. Greg wrote in Crosscut about how he doesn't want a 105-year-old parking garage giving way to a new, modern, blocky, 11-story apartment building. And we're asking Knut Berger which parts of our history are worth preserving.
Well, everybody has different opinions, and that's why you have experts that come in and tell you whether something's historic or not. You know, we have the federal government has a whole process by which neighborhoods can be designated and certain standards that have to be met. And I think one of the upsetting things about this particular case in Pioneer Square is that Pioneer Square Preservation Board voted overwhelmingly, almost unanimously, to reject the design of this particular building. And it wasn't the height. It wasn't what it was replacing. The issue is scale and the appropriateness of what it does on the street and what it and the mass of the building. And you might say, well, that's just a matter of taste. The builder should be able to do whatever they want. But when it comes to preserving the integrity of a historic district, you actually have to meet certain federal standards to get the tax benefits. So the property owners get the tax benefits of being in a historic district. So I think the issue here, and Anne Fennessy was talking about process, the thing that has people upset, I think, is the fact that a process was followed, an unprecedented decision was made by the city to overturn what the preservation board decided. And as a result, that process is being appealed. That isn't checking out. There was a lot of back and forth negotiating and whatnot. It was simply preemptively rejected by the Department of Neighborhoods. So, these things, I think they're good to debate. I think the development pressures in Seattle are posing potential threats to all the historic districts. If you read the Hala report, you'll see that many of the recommendations involved reducing or eliminating environmental review of historic districts, reject the idea of conservation districts, want to raise the bar on properties that get looked at under SEPA, which is the State Environmental Policy Act, which one of the things SEPA does is trigger whether you should look at a building's historic nature and consider what effect tearing it down might have. So I think that this is partly, it's not whether it's a garage, it's not whether it's 11 stories per se, it's about how you deal with the increasing pressures of growth and who gets to make those decisions when they get into the professional area of historic preservation.
How does all this sound to somebody who's lived here for 10 months, Katie Herzog?
It sounds like.
Have you ever heard of Pioneer Square? You're familiar.
I think that's in the earthquake zone, right?
Okay. Yes. Okay. Exactly.
Yeah. I guess this won't be an issue when the earthquake hits.
Right.
I don't see why you can't really have it both ways. If the issue is density and you have this existing structure, why tear it down and build something else when presumably they would be able to keep the facade and then change it from a parking deck to an apartment building? This seems like something that, in my brief time in Seattle, it seems like developers have a disproportionate amount of power in the city. And I wonder where the developers my assumption with these developers is that they want to make money. And if that's the thing that's driving development, that's driving, the preservation of the city, that seems like a problem. I mean, the reason that people like Pioneer Square is because it's beautiful. And they're not going to like it if it's got this, this ugly 11-story building there.
I'll give the last word to someone who's been here for longer than 10 months.
Just a tad longer.
Joni Balter.
So to me, I'm stuck on one of Anne Fennessy's comments there, which was the biggest threat was the loss of vitality. And you remember
Said it's not a dense enough neighborhood that people feel that it's a neighborhood, something like that.
It's hard to congeal or something like that. And you think about that moment when Elliott Bay Books left and how people thought, oh, my gosh, what in the world is going to happen to Pioneer Square? Well, what's going to happen to Pioneer Square within the very legitimate constraints of historic preservation is the viaduct is coming down and other things are going up in anticipation of that. And so you've got the Weyerhaeuser building's going to be big. There, you've got other buildings that are taller. And, we could talk all day about who likes which one and which one should or shouldn't go. But that really is the overarching change. Viaduct down and new buildings are going up.
Talking about which parts of history we preserve, we'll keep watching the next In fact, final DPD, that's the Seattle Planning Department hearing on that particular case, is on September 29th, in case we've gotten you interested. This is KUOW's Week in Review. Back in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This week, gun rights groups sued the city of Seattle over its adoption of a so-called gun violence tax. This is a tax on firearms and ammunition that the city says would help offset the financial cost of gun violence. Who should pay that financial cost? One of those gun rights groups suing the city is the Second Amendment Foundation. Dave Workman is with that group. Dave, welcome to KUOW.
Well, it's nice of you to invite me. Thanks very much.
The city says the cost of gun violence is being paid now by gunshot victims and by taxpayers who, for example, pay to treat uninsured patients at Harborview. Who do you think should pay that price?
Well, the gangs themselves would be the most likely persons to pay that. Of course, that's not going to happen.
The what themselves?
Should pay that themselves. You know, when these people are arrested and fined, that money should go to support these programs. But you and I both know that that's not going to happen. I think that this is a far broader responsibility than just to put that on the backs of law-abiding firearms owners. They're not the ones that are creating the problem.
So why is it the responsibility of a taxpayer who's not going to shoot anyone because they haven't bought a gun?
Why is it the responsibility of a gun owner who hasn't shot anybody? You know, we're, I think, picking nits here. You know, we have a facility, Harborview, that treats people for gunshot wounds and burns and all kinds of different things, and that is supported by local taxes, and you know, if we are going to have a situation where there are gangs and gang activities in the city of Seattle, which just the other day Police Chief O'Toole was saying that a majority of the shootings have involved gang problems, that really should not be the specific responsibility of gun shops or law-abiding firearms owners to pay the tab on that.
What about people who do get shot by legally purchased guns? Suicide victims? Innocent gunshot victims?
I'm not quite sure I understand. Nobody gets shot by a gun. They get shot by somebody using a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
And
the city wants to use the money from a tax to pay for gun violence prevention programs and gun safety research.
Well, we're talking about gun control. I mean, let's be honest here. Gun violence research is really a part and parcel of gun control, and you know, the city of Seattle is delighted to single out gun owners for this sort of thing, but quite frankly, the people who filed the lawsuit, Second Amendment Foundation, NRA, and the National Shooting Sports Foundation, you know, they're saying that the city's action is against the state preemption law, and we really are convinced of that.
We're talking with Dave Workman, who's with the Second Amendment Foundation. Our panel is answering the question, too. Knute Berger, gun violence carries a price. Who should pay it?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with taxes like this. Now, the legal question will be answered in court. You know, Workman's lawsuit has to do with the state preemption law. I remember on this show, Chris Vance insisted that the law was unconstitutional because gun rights are protected in the Constitution. But I think that theoretically, the idea of having users of a product pay money that then goes to help mitigate some of the social effects of that product, I think that's fine. And the question is the money then put into something that actually is something more than symbolic? In other words, does it actually help pay for patients at Harborview who've been shot? Or does it go to guns, you know, real gun safety classes, which, you know, if you're going to own a gun, you should go through those courses and, you know, learn how to use one.
Katie Herzog, Dave Workman says this is a broad responsibility, certainly not the responsibility of legal, law-abiding gun buyers in Seattle.
Well, then whose responsibility should it be? I mean, manufacturers and sellers that profit off of guns, it seems to me that they should be the ones paying this tax, which, frankly, I don't think is high enough. It's, what, $25 per firearm? You know, if you make it $1,000 per firearm, maybe people will actually stop buying guns, which, you know, we want less gun violence, and that's gun violence comes from guns. The issue should be getting guns off of the street. You know, this seems pretty symbolic to me, which is maybe that in itself is a good thing. You know, the city of Seattle saying we don't want guns in this city, even if people can go to Bellevue and buy their guns without paying this tax, at least the city is saying that this isn't a value that we hold.
Joni Balter, who pays the cost of gun violence?
Well, I have no problem, again, with this tax. If you and I want to be clear here, this is not a sales tax on the buyer. It's a volume tax on the business, and the business can either eat it or pass it on. There is an assumption that they're going to pass it on. But my overriding impression about all of this is that the NRA, the gun lobby, is just plain terrified that cities like Seattle or states like Washington are going to take action on guns. And so if they can't win with the voters, as in Initiative 594, the background check measure, or if they can't win with the liberal city council, they always go to court. They always challenge these things in court. And sometimes they can win because of, you know, the particulars. But you have polls that show 85% of Americans support background checks, and they still challenge all of these things in court just to see if they can, if that's the way to win it.
Dave Workman, since you're outnumbered, I'll give you the last word on who pays the cost of gun violence.
Well, hello, Newt and Joni. I appreciate this. I do feel like Custer at the Little Bighorn, but...
You'll be fine. You'll be fine.
Yeah, I know I will. If 85% of the people support background checks, why didn't we have an 85% plus vote last fall? I think only 59-point-some percent voted in favor of 594.
That's pretty high for an initiative, I will say.
It still doesn't match the number that keeps getting kicked around in the media. Newt, as far as user pays, maybe we should apply that same logic to people who are purchasing marijuana for recreational purposes, because there was a report the other day that there are an increasing number of traffic accidents that involve people who are stoned. And, you know, maybe the money ought to go there from legalized pot.
There is a tax on legalized pot that goes to prevention and education.
It goes to prevention, but it doesn't go to pay for the injuries, just the same as this gun tax will not go to help pay for the injuries and help support the Harborview program. This is going to some gun violence prevention research. Now, if you're going to apply or if you're going to tax these people, put the money where it's going to do the most good, and that would be to help defray the costs at Harborview. Wouldn't you think that's right?
Dave Workman, I know they don't think it's right, and we're out of time. Dave Workman with the Second Amendment Foundation, thanks for joining us.
You bet.
Seattle's tax would add $25 to the price of a firearm sold in the city, 2 to 5 cents per round of ammunition, the money going for gun safety research and gun violence prevention programs. And when we've been disagreeing about who ought to pay the cost that comes with guns. This is KUOW's Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. We're learning from the news of the week with Knute Berger from Crosscut, Seattle Channel's Joni Balter, from Grist, the environmental site, Katie Herzog. And we're going to talk now about this question. If you don't like how Seattle has changed, who should you blame? Two writers tackled that question this week with different results. At the website Gawker, Seattle native Chris Morris Lent wrote that Seattle is dead and Amazon killed it. Chris, why do you blame Amazon for the Seattle changes you don't like?
Well, it's a confluence of a number of factors. The sheer volume of the employees that Amazon hires, its incredible global ambition, its ruthless workplace culture, and its geographical location in the center of Seattle has attracted a different kind of person than used to come here, to the detriment, I would argue, of almost everybody.
Okay, a different kind of person, and we could talk more about that. You mentioned Amazon's location. You blame Amazon for the worsening traffic, too.
Correct. obviously it's not entirely responsible, but having something in the middle of South Lake Union is going to create a different kind of culture than having it in Redmond. South Lake Union is a terrible place, and I read with some amazement one of John's articles where he describes it as a sort of work, live, and play. You sort of have to wonder who is working there, who is living there, who is playing there. It's not really revolutionary. It's just a boomtown in the classic sense, and I think having this Disney-fied sort of Williamsburg clone is not beneficial.
Should we blame Amazon or someone else? Let's welcome Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton. John, you just heard Chris blame Amazon for bad culture, high prices, bad traffic, a ruined South Lake Union, Disneyfication. What on that list do you agree and disagree with?
Well, I'm very sorry that Christopher lost his city. I have lost my cities before, and I get that. I think it's a little over the top to say it killed Seattle, considering that Seattle City and the Seattle metropolitan area has one of the most powerful and successful economies in the country right now. Amazon, you can say, is a bad actor in a host of ways, and I've written about this before, but an urban technology campus, if you can get it right, is much more sustainable and much better for the planet than continuing to destroy land out in the suburbs.
Chris Morris-Lent, react to that. We have Amazon, as John Talton said, helping our economy succeed and in the city instead of sprawling out in the suburbs.
Sure. Well, I don't think that the economy needs any help in succeeding. I mean, when the economy has never really struggled, I would argue that things are harder economically for the average citizen in Seattle as a result of Amazon.
Well, I do want to set some context. Seattle has had bad times. Seattle faced the great Boeing slump when they didn't build the SST. I was here when WAMU went down, and downtown was in deep, deep trouble.
That's Washington Mutual for you newcomers.
Seattle has always been the commercial center of the Northwest. It has always been a city on the make. But I would rather be here than Dayton, Ohio. Dayton, Ohio is pretty close to dead. They would like to have an Amazon, but they don't get it.
So, John Talton, you've said that if you don't like a lack of transit and a lack of a park in South Lake Union, you ought to blame voters. You ought to blame us instead of Amazon.
Well, I don't know who the us is, but the fact is that voters, in the classic Seattle way, turn these things down. And they, in their minds, had what they thought were good reasons, that it was going to be a handout to Paul Allen. Well, we sure stuck it to the man. He got South Lake Union anyway. We didn't get a park. And one of the reasons for turning down the subway was, well, it only caused Seattle to grow. Well, Seattle grew anyway, and yet we have largely a 1971 transportation system.
So, Chris Morris-Lent, your premise was Amazon killed Seattle. But what about the idea that people are what make a city what it is for good or bad?
Right, but the companies attract a certain kind of person, and you can't say that the company is completely irresponsible for it. With the political leanings of Amazon people, libertarians, the chances of funding more public works that will benefit the polity as a whole is becoming increasingly unlikely, and I sort of worry that we're getting into a self-perpetuation loop.
Well, look, I've beaten up Bezos for years about his flaunting of the common good, but I would argue, and you would disagree, and we're never going to settle this, that Redmond with Microsoft is an abortion.
Yes.
And it never should have been there. Whereas what Bezos has started is an imperfect urban technology campus where you have creative friction. You got a lot more down there than just Amazon. You got biotech, you've got the University of Washington, you've got startups. You have the potential to learn how to bring these things back efficiently to a center city, as opposed to having these planet-killing suburbs.
So there you go. One writer blames Amazon for killing his idea of the way Seattle ought to be. The other writer, first of all, credits Amazon. What's to blame? We're having boom times, and that's a good thing. And by the way, a lot of the stuff you don't like, maybe you should blame the voters. And we're with Joni Balter, Katie Herzog, Knut Berger. Joni, who do you blame, since we're being negative for a few minutes, who do you blame for the Seattle you don't like?
Well, I'll get to that in 1 second here. I thought this article was pretty silly by a guy who seemed to be having trouble getting a date. What I mean by that is he was lamenting the tall women, the short guys. So I don't know. It was hard to take it very, very seriously after that. There is a boom and bust going here. The growth is going way too quickly to keep up with the infrastructure. I did a piece for Channel 9 on that. You know, I used to sort of feel like he the writer did towards some of the Amazonians. They were always on their phone as they were walking, bumping into things and all of that. But after I read that New York Times piece about how they're so mean to these employees, I kind of wanted to give them a hug, and I wasn't blaming them exactly, because it's Amazon, it's a lot of other companies that are coming here, and it's market forces that are much larger than Amazon by itself.
We're going to go to a Mossback in a moment. I like getting the point of view of a newbie. What don't you like about Seattle, and who do you blame, Katie Herzog?
Amazon, of course. No, I agree with Joni that the article on Gawker was a little bit silly. This guy was, I think he's 25 years old and is very nostalgic for his childhood, it sounds like. And I'm sorry that he can't get dates. It's hard. But the reality is that the reason I think that people hate Amazon is because there's this perception that Amazon is increasing the cost of housing. But the reality is that Amazon doesn't have anything to do with the cost of housing. It's developers, landlords, the city, the legislature who control the cost of housing and the free market. You know, what Amazon is doing, and I hate to defend Amazon, and I personally don't shop there except when I need emergency earthquake bags. But Amazon, what they're doing is paying their employees a living wage. And, you know, I really wish that I made $160,000 a year, just like, you know, people who work at Amazon. So, yes, I do think that it changes the culture of the city. But, you know, the blame, I don't think Amazon is working within a system that benefits it, that works for it. So the problem is the system. The problem is that we don't have rent control, that we don't have, you know, affordable housing. And that's not actually Amazon's fault for paying their workers well.
Katie says blame the system. Knut Berger, who are we blaming?
I blame myself.
There you go.
I've talked about the rain. I've suggested that Seattle get rid of its name and go back to Doo-Wamps.
Uh-huh.
I think that would help, you know.
You've done everything
right.
You can.
I've done everything I can. I actually agree with both of them. I thought John Talton's column was good. Seattle isn't dead, obviously. And you can make any argument that the Seattle you grew up in is dead. I get that. No, the city is alive. But I think that one of the things that I hate in these arguments is getting drawn into this false choice between boom and bust. This false choice which says, well, you know, we have Amazon, but what do you want? What about Detroit?
Right.
What about Dayton? You know, that isn't the choice. I mean, it is possible, I think, to create something that's a middle ground, that's something where you have vitality, but you also have livability. You also have a way of doing this gracefully, doing this humanely. And I think we often err way too far on the side of helping people who don't need help.
Knut, that clock tells you we have 30 seconds. So in one word, what city has done it right then? What city has said no to growth?
Well, Portland has done a better job of managing growth.
Portland! Did it again. Knut Berger, the Mossback from Crosscut, Katie Herzog from Grist, Joni Balter, Seattle Channel. We've been discussing the week in review. The show produced by Hannah Byrne this time around. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you, everybody, for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank
Bill.
You.
We're at KUOW when you tweet, and we're at Facebook, KUOW Public Radio.